After much discussion by various white members on the same subject, Mr. F.L. Cardozo, colored, voiced the thought of colored men who demanded that the government furnish land for the freedmen. The poor freedmen are induced, by many congressmen even, to expect confiscation. They held out the hope of confiscation. General Sherman did confiscate, gave the lands to the freedmen, and if it were not for President Johnson, they would have them now. The hopes of the freedmen have not been realized, and I do not think that asking for a loan of $1 million to be paid by a mortgage upon the land will be half as bad as has been supposed. I have been told by the Assistant Commissioner that he has been doing on a private scale what this petition proposes. I say every opportunity of helping the colored people should be seized upon. I think the adoption of this measure should be seized upon. We should certainly vote for some measure of relief for the colored men, as we have to the white men who mortgaged their property to perpetuate slavery and whom they have liberated from their bonds. Mr. W. J. Whipper, colored, was more conservative and only wanted protection from immediate monopoly. The present owners will be compelled before long to sell portions of their land, and sell them to freedmen or whoever can pay for them, but if sold now, they will be sold in large bodies or large tracts, so that nobody but a capitalist will be able to buy. This demand for land was characterized as demagoguery by the property holders, but land was, as many speakers suggested, the economic means of raising the level of the electorate. A petition was passed by a great majority, asking Congress to appropriate funds for buying land, but Senator Wilson replied that this was impractical, and the convention thereupon created a state commission for buying lands and selling them to the freedmen. The convention attacked race discrimination squarely. A colored man, Dr. B. F. Randolph, offered the following amendment: distinction on account of race or color in any case whatever shall be prohibited, and all classes of citizens, irrespective of race and color, shall enjoy all common, equal, and political privileges. He said, "It is doubtless the impression of the members of the convention that the Bill of Rights, as it stands, secures perfect political and legal equality to all the people of South Carolina. It is a fact, however, that nowhere is it laid down in the instrument, emphatically and definitely, that all the people of the state, irrespective of race and color, shall enjoy equal privileges. Our forefathers were no doubt anti-slavery men, and they intended that slavery should die out. Consequently, the word color is not to be found in the Constitution or Declaration of Independence. On the contrary, it stated all men are created free and equal. In our Bill of Rights, I want to settle the question forever by making the meaning so plain that a wayfaring man, though a fool, cannot misunderstand it. The majority of the people of South Carolina who are rapidly becoming property holders are colored citizens, the descendants of the African race, who have been ground down by 300 years of degradation, and now that the opportunity is afforded, let them be protected by their political rights. The words proposed as an amendment were not calculated to create distinction, but to destroy distinction. And since the Bill of Rights did not declare equality, irrespective of race or color, it was important that they should be inserted. Thus, discriminations of race and color were abolished by the Constitution, and practical application was attempted in the case of the public schools and the militia. The convention framed the most liberal provisions for the right of suffrage that any of the Southern constitutions provided. They did not attempt, as in Virginia, Alabama, and Mississippi, to restrict the voting of whites further than was provided by the Reconstruction Acts. Indeed, Whipper, a colored delegate, wished to petition Congress to remove all political disabilities from the white citizens. In this, Cardozo and Nash agreed, and the motion was passed. Of course, they made no distinction in race and color. The rights of women were enlarged. The property of married women could not be sold for their husbands' debts, and for the first time in its history, the state was given a divorce law. Education was discussed at length, and a free common school system voted for. It is sufficient to say here that for the first time, the fundamental law of the state carried the obligation of universal education and demanded the creation of a school system like that of northern states. Nothing that the convention did aroused more opposition among property-holding whites. In the first place, as a white woman told a northern teacher, "I do assure you that you might as well try to teach your horse or mule to read as to teach these niggers." In the second place, the whites calculated that the school system would cost $900,000 a year and that the new taxation would fall upon them. In the debate on the school system, there was not a moment's hesitation, but there was considerable difference of opinion as to whether education should be made compulsory or not. R.C. DeLarge, colored, said in the debate, "The schools may be open to all, but to declare that parents should send their children to them, whether they are willing or not, is, in my judgment, going a step beyond the bounds of prudence. Is there any logic or reason in inserting in the Constitution a provision which cannot be enforced?" Mr. A.J. Ransier, colored, said, "I am sorry to differ with my colleague from Charleston on this question. I contend that in proportion to the education of the people, so is their progress in civilization. Believing this, I believe that the committee has properly provided for the compulsory education of all children in this state between the ages named in the section." Mr. J. A. Chestnut, colored, spoke on separation in schools. "Has not this convention the right to establish a free school system for the poor classes? Then, if there be a hostile disposition among the whites, an unwillingness to send their children to school, the fault is their own, not ours. Look at the idle youth around us. Is the sight not enough to invigorate every man with a desire to do something to remove this vast weight of ignorance that presses the masses down? I have no desire to curtail the privileges of freedmen, but when we look at the opportunities neglected, even by the whites of South Carolina, I must confess that I am more than ever disposed to compel parents, especially of my own race, to send their children to school. If the whites object to it, let it be so." Mr. F. L. Cardozo said, "It was argued by some yesterday, with some considerable weight, that we should do everything in our power to incorporate in the Constitution all possible measures that will conciliate those opposed to us. No one would go further in conciliating others than I would, but we should be careful of what we do to conciliate. In the first place, there is an element that is opposed to us no matter what we do, which will never be conciliated. It is not that they are opposed so much to the Constitution we may frame, but they are opposed to us sitting in the convention. Their objection is of such a radical and fundamental nature that any attempt to frame a constitution to please them would be abortive. In the next place, there are those who are doubtful, and gentlemen here say if we frame a constitution to suit these parties, they will come over to our side. They are only waiting to see whether or not it will be successful. Then there is the third class, who honestly question our capacity to frame a constitution. I respect that class and believe if we do justice to them, laying our cornerstone on a sure foundation of republican government and liberal principles, the intelligence of that class will be conciliated, and they are worthy of conciliation. Before I proceed to discuss the question, I want to divest it of all false issue of the imaginary consequences that some gentlemen have illogically thought will result from the adoption of this section with the word compulsory. They affirm that it compels the attendance of both white and colored children in the same schools. There is nothing of the kind in this section. It simply says that all the children shall be educated. But how, it is left with the parents to decide. It is left to the parent to say whether the child should be sent to a public or private school. There can be separate schools for white and colored. It is left so that if any colored child wishes to go to a white school, it shall have the privilege of doing so. I have no doubt, in most localities, colored people will prefer separate schools, particularly until some of the present prejudice against their race is removed. The committee proposed that persons coming of age after 1875 must be able to read and write before voting, but Cardozo opposed it because he said it would take more than 10 years and a great deal of money to complete the system, and he wanted to extend the time to 1890. Three other colored members spoke against any qualification, and it was, therefore, stricken out. To bridge over the interval before the state school system could be installed, Mr. B. F. Randolph, colored, presented the following petition, which was referred to the Committee on Miscellaneous Provisions of the Constitution. We, the undersigned, people of South Carolina, in the convention assembled, do hereby recommend that the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands be continued until the restoration of civil authority, that then a Bureau of Education be established in order that an efficient system of schools be established. Perhaps the convention's achievement of greatest permanent importance was the reform of local and judicial administration. Judicial circuits were to be called counties, and some new counties were arranged. A court of probate was established in each county, and justices of the peace were given wider jurisdiction. Judges were to be elected instead of appointed, and in spite of such criticism, the new system worked well. From 1870 to 1877, the Supreme Court was composed of a Negro, a native Southerner, and a Northerner. Its administration was fair, and its decisions just. Most of the circuit judges were native whites and honest men. Mixed juries were the rule, and no fault was found with them. They did not hesitate to convict colored prisoners. The trial judges came in for the greatest criticism. Among them were numbers of ignorant and unqualified persons, and there were a good deal of misappropriation of fees and costs. On the other hand, it was difficult to get proper trial judges because so many qualified whites refused to serve. Wright, the Negro who was on the Supreme Court, was the first colored man admitted to the bar in Pennsylvania. He had been connected with the Freedmen's Bureau, then became a member of the Constitutional Convention and a state senator. He was elected to the bench in February 1870 to fill out an unexpired term, and was re-elected in December 1870 for the full term. He resigned under Hampton in August 1877. Although he lisped, Wright was a good speaker, decidedly intelligent, and generally said to be the best-fitted colored man in the state for the position. Some reforms were made in the county government. Most of the officers were to be elected by popular vote, and boards of commissioners were appointed for the highways and for collection and disbursement of taxes. Some of the delegates wanted to legislate concerning wages, which caused great indignation among the planters. It was suggested, for instance, that planters be required to pay back wages from the time of the issue of the Emancipation Proclamation, and that the division of one half of the crop for tenant farmers be made compulsory. Such legislation was inherently just and reasonable, but 50 years too early for public opinion in any modern country. Among other things, the Constitution abolished imprisonment for debt and dueling, and did away with property qualifications for voting or holding office. The colored members, despite their inexperience, gave evidence here and there of care and thrift. For instance, when the question of the pay of members of the convention came up, a discussion arose. Mr. L. S. Langley moved that the pay per diem of $12 in bills receivable be laid on the table. J. J. Wright moved that $10 be inserted. N. G. Parker, white, moved to fix the pay at $11. C. P. Leslie, colored, demurred. I desire to say a word before that resolution be passed and be put right on record. I am perfectly willing to receive $3 per day in greenbacks for my services. I think that sum all they are worth. And further, if I got any more, it would be so much more than I have been in the habit of receiving. I might possibly go on a spree and lose the whole of it. Now, I ask any of the delegates in this body if they were called upon to pay a similar body of men out of their pockets, how much they would be willing to pay each member. I will stake my existence on it that they would not pay more than $1.50 per day to each member. I want to be recorded as always being opposed to a high tariff, but not against any reasonable compensation. But this $8 or $9 a day, when we consider all the surroundings and conditions of the people, looks too much like a fraud. The new Constitution for South Carolina was adopted by the convention in April 1868. It was eventually adopted by the people, 70,000 voting for it, 27,000 against it, and 35,000 abstaining. The Constitution was written in good English and was an excellent document, embodying some of the best legal principles of the age. In letter, it was as good as any other constitution the state has ever had, or as most American states had at that time. The assertion is supported by the practical endorsement which a subsequent generation of South Carolinians gave it. The conservative whites were content to live under it for 18 years after they recovered control of the state government, and when, in 1895, they met to make a new constitution, the document they produced had many of the features of the Constitution of 1868. It was not, of course, an original document, either in form or wording, but copied largely from northern state models. But colored men discussed it, amended it, and voted for its adoption. They shared in the capacity and thought that made it. A convention of whites held in Columbia April 2nd condemned the Constitution as the work of 60-odd Negroes, many of them ignorant and depraved, together with 50 white men, outcasts of Northern society, and Southern renegades, betrayers of their race and country. Its franchise provisions were declared to be designed to further the ambitions of mean whites, its judicial system repugnant to our customs and habits of thought, the homestead provision a snare and deceit, and the stupendous school arrangement a fruitful source of peculant corruption. Here spoke capital, land, and privilege against white and black labor. In the spring of 1868, the Fairfield Herald declared the revolution the maddest, most unscrupulous, and infamous revolution in history, which has snatched the power from the hands of the race which settled the country and transferred it to its former slaves, an ignorant and feeble race. Indeed, the criticism here was just as boundless and intemperate as that directed later toward the expenditures of the legislature, only in this case we have the evidence of the Constitution itself to show how excellent a document it was. The economic revolution which Reconstruction involved overshadowed and guided all thought and action. Usury laws had been repealed by the planters in 1866, and rates of interest rose to 25% and 30%. Banks commonly charged from 18% to 24%. The owners of land and property, the persons of intelligence and social prestige, despite their partial impoverishment of the war, were strong and well organized. They put the whole blame on abolition of slavery, enfranchisement of labor, and refusal of black men to work under essentially the same conditions as formerly. But colored Congressman Rainey of South Carolina well said in the 42nd Congress, "If the country there is impoverished, it has certainly not been caused by the fault of those who love the Union, but it is simply the result of a disastrous war madly waged against the best government known to the world. The murder of unarmed men and the maltreating of helpless women can never make restitution for the losses which are the simple inevitable consequence of the rebellion. The faithfulness of my race during the entire war in supporting and protecting the families of their masters speaks volumes in their behalf as to the real kindliness of their feelings toward the white people of the South. South Carolina property had been valued in 1860 at $489,319,128. All the capital in slaves was lost, but the remainder was $278,116,128. This shrank to $90,888,436 in 1866. In 1870, the property of South Carolina was assessed at $183,913,337. Besides this, millions were lost in bank stocks, endowments, and investments. One newspaper estimated that the gross property values shrank from $400 million in 1860 to $50 million in 1865. Of course, much of this was guesswork. The values of 1860 were inflated. The values of 1865 to 1870 perhaps unduly depressed. The builders of the new state wanted to make taxes uniform and therefore provided for a revaluation of lands and improvements. A committee was appointed to investigate the financial status and the new school system, which was expected to be the largest item of expense. A splendid commentary upon the new spirit which had arisen in the state was guaranteed an annual levy on all property and a poll tax. The property holders wanted to limit state indebtedness and prevent the legislature from extending credit to private corporations, but these suggestions were not approved of. The convention had a vision of prosperity, and they wanted railroads, schools, and poorhouses, and a distribution of land. In a progressive age, said Judge Wright, the legislature must do its part, and the responsibility of that body to the people was sufficient check against extravagance. The committee of property holders was alarmed and estimated that it would cost $2,230,950 annually to run the state instead of $350,000, which had sufficed before the war. This was true, but when later the expenditure of the state reached this sum, these same people complained that the expenditure must on its face be fraudulent. Singularly enough, it is conveniently forgotten that a good proportion of the white officials of South Carolina during Reconstruction were not Northerners, but Southerners, and several of them had served in the Confederate Army. Moses, who became governor, Robertson, United States Senator, and Neagle, comptroller and former Confederate officer, were Southern white men. Bowen, a congressman, while born in the North, had lived in Georgia before the war and served as captain in the Confederate Army. Of the white Northerners, Chamberlain, shrewd and able, but not over-scrupulous, was the leader. Among the others were Scott, well-meaning but not a strong governor, the pliable Parker, inefficient state treasurer, and Patterson, who bribed his way to defeat a Negro for the United States Senate. The first governor under the new regime was Robert K. Scott, born in Pennsylvania, a colonel of Union troops during the war and assistant commissioner of the Freedmen's Bureau. Scott faced great difficulties and is generally conceded to have been a well-meaning man. A well-born native Southern white was Franklin J. Moses, Jr. His father had been a prominent South Carolinian, senator before the war, and was respected by all people. Moses married the daughter of a distinguished Southerner, was private secretary to one of the former governors, and became a lawyer and an editor in favor of Johnson's Reconstruction. When the Reconstruction Acts were passed, he went over to the side of the carpetbaggers and Negroes. He took a prominent part in the Constitutional Convention, and afterward became Speaker of the House, and in 1872, governor. He was denounced as unscrupulous and dishonest, and extravagant in his manner of living. The colored leaders formed a very interesting group. Francis L. Cardozo was freeborn of Negro, Jewish, and Indian descent. He was educated at the University of Glasgow and in London, and went to New Haven, where he served as a Presbyterian minister. After the war, he came to Charleston and was principal of Avery Institute. He was Secretary of State during 1868 to 1872, and treasurer of the state during 1872 to 1876. He was a handsome, well-groomed man, with cultivated manners and honest in official life. He was accused in several instances, but no dishonest act was ever proven against him. Joseph H. Rainey was the first Negro to represent South Carolina in the House of Representatives. Robert Brown Elliott, born in Massachusetts, was educated at Eton College in England. He was a first-rate lawyer, served in the legislature, and was twice elected to Congress. He had a commanding presence and a fine gift of oratory. Richard A. Kane was a leader and afterward bishop in the AME Church. His paper, The Missionary Record, was the most influential Negro paper in South Carolina. He served in the Senate and two terms in Congress. Robert C. DeLarge was a tailor from Charleston and had been an agent in the Freedmen's Bureau. He served in the legislature, and while his education was limited, he had large influence. Beverly Nash had been a slave before the war, and afterward a waiter. When grown, he learned to read and write and became an earnest and hard-working leader. Alonzo J. Ransier was elected lieutenant governor in 1870. He was a free Negro and became a member of the Constitutional Convention of the Legislature and auditor of Charleston County. In 1872, he went to Congress. He made a good presiding officer of the state Senate, being dignified and alert. Richard H. Gleaves was lieutenant governor in 1872 to 1876. He was from Pennsylvania and had acted as probate judge. He was intelligent and knew parliamentary law. Samuel J. Lee was a Negro Speaker of the House in 1872 to 1874. He was born in the state, worked as a farmer and laborer in lumber mills, and was self-educated. He was polished and a good lawyer. Stephen A. Swales, a colored man of Pennsylvania, was a Union soldier and school teacher. He became a senator and was known for his integrity and ability as a speaker. Robert Smalls was the one who stole the Confederate ship Planter and delivered it to the Union authorities. He was self-educated and popular. He was a member of Congress until after Reconstruction. These men were all poor, and doubtless some of them accepted bribes and shared in graft, but very few of them were thoroughly venal or purchasable against their convictions. When it came to personal favors, or sharing in gifts and gains which followed legislation of which they honestly approved, some of them were certainly approachable. Negroes were conspicuous members of the legislatures. There was a large proportion of former slaves, and at first perhaps two-thirds of them could not write, but by 1871 most of them had learned at least to read and write. Many of them were speakers of force and eloquence, while others were silent or crude. In the Senate, it was said that some of the colored members spoke exceedingly well, with great ease and grace of manners. Others were awkward and coarse. One observer recorded that the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, both colored, were elegant and accomplished men, highly educated, who would have creditably presided over any Commonwealth's legislative assembly. The majority of the voters of the state were Negroes, and in every session but one, that race had a majority in the legislature. They outnumbered, and in many cases outshone, their carpetbag and scalawag contemporaries. In the first legislature, there were 127 members, of whom 87 were colored, and 40 white. It will be seen from these figures that the white members of the legislature, from their control of the Senate, were always able to block Negro legislators, and that Negro control of the legislature was only possible because most of the white senators voted with the Negroes. In the legislature of 1874, the whites had a majority in both houses. It can hardly be said, therefore, that the Negroes of South Carolina had absolute control of the state at any time. The economic status of the legislature of 1870 to 1871 is shown by their given occupations: 10 lawyers, 31 farmers, 9 physicians, 17 clergymen, 12 teachers, 16 planters, 13 merchants, 3 merchant tailors, 3 clerks, 2 masons, 8 builders, 1 engineer, 1 marble dealer, 8 carpenters, 2 hotel keepers, 1 druggist, 1 bookkeeper, 1 wheelwright, 4 coachmakers, 1 tanner, 2 mechanics, 1 chemist, 1 auditor, 1 hatter, 1 blacksmith, 1 tailor. The state sent 7 Negroes to Congress, made 2 of them lieutenant governors, and for 4 years, 2 of them were speakers of the House. 1 was Secretary of State and Treasurer of the state. Another was Adjutant and Inspector General. These men were of various colors and mixtures of blood, and there was a good deal of difference of opinion as to whether the mulattoes or the full-blooded blacks were superior. But one observer asserted that the colored men generally were superior in decency and ability to the majority of the native white radical legislators. And another said that the quadroons and octoroons of the Senate are infinitely superior in personal appearance to their white Yankee and native compeers. Most of these men had been slaves, although a few of them were well-educated. They had ability, and in some cases more than ordinary ability, but above all, they were in the midst of a mighty social and economic change, and were swayed by the social and political revolution around them. The bottom rail was at the top, and the former ruling oligarchy was now displaced by those who represented neither the wealth nor the traditions of the state. The bitterness of this campaign against the Reconstruction governments was almost inconceivable. One unfamiliar with the situation would think the editors and their correspondents had gone crazy with anger or were obsessed with some fearful mania. So great was the ridicule, contempt, and obloquy showered upon the representatives of the state. With the deepest scorn for a scalawag, with all the southern hatred for an adventuring Yankee, and with either sympathy or shame for the ignorant, misled Negro, the press, the aristocracy, the poor whites, the upcountry, the low country, all with one voice protested against the unlawful assembly in Columbia maintained in power, they said, by the federal bayonet. The Fairfield Herald battled against the hell-born policy which has trampled the fairest and noblest states of our great sisterhood beneath the unholy hoofs of African savages and shoulder-strapped brigands, the policy which has given up millions of our free-born, high-souled brethren and sisters, countrymen and countrywomen of Washington, Rutledge, Marion, and Lee, to the rule of gibbering, louse-eaten, devil-worshipping barbarians from the jungles of Dahomey and peripatetic buccaneers from Cape Cod, Memphremagog, Hell, and Boston. A new system of taxation came in with the Reconstruction government. It provided for a uniform rate of assessment on all property at its full value. This was a departure from the system previous to the war, which put a low valuation on land and slaves and heavy taxation on merchants, professions, and banking. The merchant before the war paid 5 or 6 times as great a rate of taxation as the planter. In 1859, the total tax value of lands in the state was $10,257,000, while lots and buildings in Charleston were valued at $22,274,000. The tax on all the land of the state averaged less than 5 cents an acre in 1860. When the new system came in, it was difficult to find persons to administer it, and every landholder objected to it. The new system met all sorts of opposition from unsympathetic administrators and the newspapers of the state. Governor Scott expected $300 million worth of property as a basis of taxation, but less than $115 million were returned. This, the Board of Equalization raised to $180 million. As the assessments decreased, the rate of taxation increased. The total assessment in 1869 was $181 million, and in 1877, under Hampton, $101 million. As the average rate of taxes rose, the property holder said that the Negro government wanted to raise taxes so as to confiscate the land. The new government could not collect the tax levied. It met and organized in bitter boycott of property. In 1868, $175,688 of assessed tax was uncollected. In 1869, $248,165, and in 1870, $524,026, a total of nearly $1 million in 3 years. Part of this delinquency was due to real poverty, but part was due to deliberate obstruction on the part of property holders. Taxation had to be increased to cover delinquency and to meet new expenses. In 1860, taxation on a half billion of property was $1,280,383. In 1870, $2,767,675 was assessed on $183 million. The increase of taxation was partly accounted for by gradual increased expenditures for education, construction, and charitable institutions. At the same time, the inflation of the currency makes comparison with conditions previous to the war difficult. More money was certainly raised by the state during Reconstruction, but on the other hand, a much larger proportion of the expenditures was designed to aid the laboring poor, and did aid them largely. Indeed, it might have changed the whole economic position of the proletariat if it had been efficiently and honestly expended. In the legislature in 1868, the free common school system was organized temporarily and permanently in 1870. Relief was extended to various classes of citizens, especially poor laborers. In 1868 and 1869, an act was passed providing for a land commissioner who was to act under a board. Land was to be purchased in various parts of the state and was to be sold in plots of not less than 25 and not more than 100 acres to actual settlers. $200,000 worth of bonds were provided to finance this proposal, and later this was increased to $500,000. The land commissioner was to hold office at the pleasure of an advisory board consisting of chief state officers. One of the chief sources of corruption in nearly all of the reconstructed states was railroad building, and the reasons for this are easily misconceived because of the changed economic status of railroads today. It must be remembered that at the beginning, throughout the country and the world, the railroad was a public highway, and for this reason a public enterprise toward whose building and maintenance the public rightly contributed. It was only after the railroad was built and established by public funds that private interests monopolized it and sequestered its income to make individual millionaires. In the South, the railroads had lagged. The planters would not submit to public taxation, and they would not divert funds from their private luxury consumption in order to furnish capital. South Carolina was particularly a case in point. Charleston, by all rules of commerce, should have been one of the great ports of the United States. It was a gateway to the West. It should have at least connected its own uplands with the coast, and it might have tapped the West through Cincinnati and the Great Cotton Belt through the Southern South. But efforts toward this end before the war had but small success. It was perfectly natural that the first thought of those who were reconstructing the state should turn toward railroad building as a means of economic rehabilitation. The usual method was the old one of loaning credit of the state. It meant not that the state invested money, but simply that the state permitted the issue of bonds and guaranteed the payment of interest and principal. On a sound economic proposition, conducted by honest men, this was simply a way of securing private capital for a semi-public enterprise, which would greatly increase the prosperity of the state. Railway mileage in South Carolina had increased from 289 to 973 between 1850 and 1860. By 1865, there were 1,007 miles. Then, construction practically stopped, and effort was turned toward rebuilding the railroads and giving them new equipment. The difficulty was that a flock of Comorants, whose businesses was cheating and manipulating in the issue and sale of bonds and other certificates of enterprise, moved first west and then south and took charge of railroad promotion. They were largely northern financiers, in some cases already discredited in the centers of finance and driven out of the overworked investment fields north and west. They came south with an address and a technique which only trained, experienced, and honest administrators could have withstood. They flaunted the chances of quick and easy money before the faces of ruined planters, small northern investors, and the few Negroes who had some little capital. The result was widespread graft, debt, and corruption in South Carolina and North Carolina, in Florida and Georgia, in Louisiana, and in other states. There was, however, in the reorganization, for instance, of the Greenville and Columbia Railroad, nothing worse than the ordinary stock-jobbing enterprise common all over the nation. And prominent Southerners, like ex-Governor Orr and J.P. Reed, were concerned in it. Instead of concentrating efforts on the rebuilding of the railroad and its equipment, most of the time and energy was spent in seeking to market stock in New York. This failed, and the road was bankrupt by the end of the Reconstruction era, just as it was at the beginning. In the same way, the Blue Ridge Road, backed not only by carpetbaggers but by leading white Southerners, was prostrate after the war and sued for state aid. The legislature authorized aid in 1868, but the contract for rebuilding demanded much more money than the bonds provided for. Eventually, the road was sold to a private company composed, as usual, not only of carpetbaggers, but of planters. Matters were so manipulated that a state contingent liability of $4 million of bonds was transmuted into an actual state indebtedness of $1,800,000. Again, little was done, actually, to restore the road, and the company went into bankruptcy. Thus, in most cases, bankrupt corporations, bequeathed to the Reconstruction regime by antebellum organizers, came before the legislature to secure capital for rebuilding, and then fell into the hands of speculators who tried to make money out of the stock rather than out of the rebuilding of the road. And these speculators were largely men trained in shady finance in Wall Street, and helped by much of the best element of the Southerners in South Carolina, as well as by the new carpetbag capitalists. This was a difficult situation, calling for blame and criticism, but to place the blame of it mainly upon the Negro voter and the Negro laborer is a fantastic distortion of the truth. The money misused went primarily to Northern promoters and Southern white administrators, and while, of course, a poverty-stricken electorate was gripped and bribed by such organized thieves, the remedy for this was not the disfranchisement of labor, but its education, and such an increased share of the product of industry as to make life livable without theft or sale of soul. The appropriations to meet the new expenses had to grow. The fact is that South Carolina had been a state absolutely dominated by landed property. It is said that the antebellum state was ruled by 180 great landlords. They had made the functions of the state just as few as possible, and did by private law and on private plantations most of the things which in other states were carried on by the local and state governments. The economic revolution, therefore, which universal suffrage envisaged for this state, was perhaps greater than in any other southern state. It was for this reason that the right of the masses to vote was so bitterly assailed, and expenditures for the new functions of the state denounced as waste and extravagance. The result of all this had to be increased taxation. The rate of taxation in 1868 to 1872 was 9 mills. In 1872 to 1876, over 11 mills. Yet this was excessive only by comparison with the past, and because of recent severe losses. In northern states, like Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, and Pennsylvania, the average was 21.5 mils on the dollar. The grip of poverty was on the South, and poverty always is felt most poignantly by those to whom poverty has been unknown. The planters, used to ease and a certain degree of luxury, were the ones that felt the new poverty as a terrible, heaven-shattering thing. They looked upon any action as justifiable if it restored to them the income which they had lost. On the other hand, both the poor whites and the Negroes were not only poverty-stricken, but for that reason, peculiarly susceptible to petty graft and bribery. Economically, they had always been stripped bare. A little cash was a curiosity, and a few dollars a fortune. The sale of their votes and political influence was therefore, from the first, simply a matter of their knowledge and conception of what the vote was for and what it could procure. With experience, their conception of its value rose until some of them conceived the idea of making the ballot a power by which they could change their social and economic status and live like human beings. But before most of them rose to this conception, there were thousands to whom their vote and petty office holding were simply a means of adding to their small incomes. And when one considers that this was a day when the line between using political power for personal advantage and using it for social uplift was dim and difficult to follow throughout the whole nation, the wonder is that the labor vote of South Carolina so easily ranged itself behind the new school system, the orphanages, the land distribution, and the movements toward reform in public efficiency. The ascendancy of property over labor and the suffrage was in this day openly maintained by bribery, and if this had been uncommon in the pre-war South, it was simply because universal suffrage had not been established and capital ruled by social sanction rather than by money. In the new situation, property began systematically to attack labor in two ways. First, it deliberately encouraged extravagance, graft, and bribery so as to hasten the downfall of the labor regime. And secondly, it utterly upset the credit of the state so as to prevent the new state from importing capital. The failure of taxation to raise the required revenue compelled the state to borrow, and here it fell into the hands of northern money sharks and southern repudiators. The state debt October 1, 1867, was $8,378,255. The Constitutional Convention of 1868 repudiated $3 million of this as a Confederate debt and made the total debt $5,407,306. From this beginning, the state debt increased to $10,665,908 in 1871, while committees claimed that there was evidence of total liabilities outstanding to the amount of 15 or even 30 millions. The exact amount of the debt was not known. The figures, from the reports of the treasurer, comptroller general, and financial agent, did not agree. And it was claimed by the opposition press, and even by some of the state officials, that there were large issues of fraudulent bonds on the market, and that certain of the state officials had profited thereby. While the conservative press continually reviled the radical government, on no topic was it so prolific or bitter as that of finances and taxation. In this case, the total indebtedness in 1871 is not clear. The governor's report makes it a little less than $12 million, but the investigation committee insists that because the state government had printed and issued certain bonds, the amount of which was not definitely known, it was possible that the state might eventually be liable for $30 million. This did not mean, as many assume, that the state officials received or squandered any such sums. The methods by which small amounts of actual cash received became a paper debt of huge amounts is explained in the governor's special message of January 9, 1865. In the fall of 1868, I visited New York City for the purpose of borrowing money on the credit of the state, on coupon bonds under the provisions of the Acts of August 26, 1868. I had the assistance of Mr. H.H. Kempton, United States Senator F.A. Sawyer, and Mr. George S. Cameron. I called at several of the most prominent banking houses to effect the negotiation of the required loan, and they refused to advance any money upon our state securities, for those securities had been already branded with the threat of a speedy repudiation by the political opponents of the administration who have ever since howled the same cry against the state credit. As the persons who made this threat controlled the press of the state, they were enabled to impress capitalists abroad with the false idea of a speedy reaction that would soon place them again in authority. As the capitalists well knew that these persons, when in power in 1862, did repudiate their debts due northern creditors, their distrust of our bonds was very natural and apparently well-founded. It soon became evident to every man familiar with our financial standing in New York that to negotiate the loan authorized, the question was not what we would take for the bonds, but what we would get for them. After much effort and the most judicious management, I succeeded in borrowing money through Mr. Cameron at the rate of $4 in bonds for $1 in currency, the bonds being rated at 75% below their par value, or at 25 cents on the dollar. This loan, however, was only effected at the extravagant rate of 1.5% per month, or 18% a year, a rate only demanded on the most doubtful paper to cover what is deemed a great risk for the money loaned. Subsequent loans were effected at a higher valuation of the bonds, but at the rates of interest varying from 15% to 20%, in addition to commissions necessarily to be paid the financial agent. If, then, $3,200,000 in money has cost the state $9,514,000 in bonds, it does not, therefore, follow that the financial board has criminally conspired against the credit of the state, and still less that any one member of the board can justly be held up to public execution or stigmatized by an accusation of high crimes and misdemeanors for the assumed results of its action. It is proper that I should add that the armed violence which has prevailed in this state for the past 3 years has had upon our bonds the same effect as actual war in lessening their purchasing value, as money is dearer in war than in peace. Ku Kluxism made capitalists shrink from touching the bonds of this state, as a man would shrink from touching a pestilential body. If there were outstanding, in 1874, 20 or even 30 millions of evidences of debt, it is unlikely that this represented more than 10 millions in actual cash delivered, and all monies collected and paid beyond that were not the stealing necessarily of South Carolinians, white or black, but the financial graft of Wall Street and its agents, made possible by the slander and reaction of the planters. The rise of a group of a people is not a simultaneous shift of the whole mass. It is a continuous differentiation of individuals with inner strife and differences of opinion, so that individuals, groups, and classes begin to appear seeking higher levels, groping for better ways, uniting with other like-minded bodies and movements. Every indication of this was present among Negroes during Reconstruction times. There was not a single reform movement, a single step toward protest, a single experiment for betterment in which Negroes were not found in varying numbers. The protest against corruption and inefficiency in South Carolina had, in every case, Negro adherents, and in many cases, Negro leaders. The responsibility of Negroes for the government of South Carolina in Reconstruction was necessarily limited. They helped choose the elected officials and furnished a large number of the members of the legislature, but most of the administrative power was in the hands of the whites, and these were either Northerners who had come south as officers or officials or to invest money, or native Southerners, both aristocrats and poor whites, who had undertaken to guide the Negro vote. As a majority of the electorate, Negroes were responsible for the officials elected, but their choice was limited. They had among themselves a few notable leaders, some educated in the North, a few educated Southern Negroes, and other Southern Negroes with little formal education but much hard sense. Three groups gradually formed themselves among the whites, those like General Orr, who represented the planters and who were willing to accept Negro suffrage as a fact. Others, like Wade Hampton, proposed to control the Negro vote, but to control it in the interest of the planters, and eventually to limit it in various ways. Then there was a third party, led by men like B.F. Perry, who wanted to exclude the Negro entirely from the ballot and do this as soon as possible, frankly, on lines of race and color. Perry feared a union of poor whites and Negroes, and saw in this a menace of proletarian revolution and an attack on property. I greatly fear. There are many white persons in South Carolina who will vote for a convention under the hope of its repudiating the indebtedness of the state. This class may influence the Negro vote to unite with them, and then, in return, they can unite with the Negro in parceling out the lands of the state. One step leads to another. Stay law first, repudiation next, and then follows a division of lands and an equal appropriation of property amongst all persons, and last of all, the honest, hard-working, industrious, and prudent class must support the idle, dissipated, extravagant, and roguish class. It was this last group that eventually dominated and transported to South Carolina the Mississippi plan of overthrowing the Negro vote by brute force. The path of black leaders under these circumstances was exceedingly difficult. Many Negroes of importance, such as Rainey, Lomax, and King, openly attacked the course of Republican administration. R.H. King formed a Negro reform movement and said, "We would favor to send to the legislature honest mechanics and farmers whose minds are not biased by chicanery. At any rate, have honest men who are identified with prosperity and the people's interest." But on the other hand, most Negroes were afraid of combination with the white planters, who clearly would disfranchise them if they had the chance. As the state debt increased, a taxpayers' convention met in Columbia in May 1871, with 30 counties represented and a few Negro delegates. It protested against the increase in the public debt and the high taxation and attacked the financial legislation. It warned persons not to buy bonds or obligations issued by the present state government because the property holders were not adequately represented in the legislature. Several Negroes were members of this convention, and the same year, leading Negroes, including DeLarge, Nash, and Robert Smalls, tried to form a new political party. It was admitted that there were abuses which needed reformation, but on the whole, the Republican Party was gratified at the result of the taxpayers' convention. A joint committee of the legislature made an examination of the financial condition of the state in 1871. This extended over several months. It declared that the total bonded debt of the state was $15,767,908. This joint committee denounced the state officials, the land commission, and the financial agent. An attempt was made to impeach Scott and Parker, the treasurer, and it was charged that they bribed members of the legislature to stop the proceedings. In this way, doubt was spread upon the validity of much of the bonded debt, and the credit of the state was almost entirely destroyed. There was no money in the treasury and no way of meeting expenses. Northern capitalists were warned repeatedly about taking the bonds. With all this went undoubted efforts to improve the state. An orphan asylum was authorized in 1869. The poor of the state were provided for in 1870. And the system was kept after the whites came into power. An institution for the deaf, dumb, and blind was started in 1871. It lasted until 1873, and then the faculty resigned because they were ordered to accept colored students. A lunatic asylum was provided and colored patients admitted. Casting aside all questions of race and forgetting temporarily its setting among a severely defeated and hostile people, but bearing in mind the uniqueness of this new experiment, an experiment of universal education among persons unaccustomed to such, this free public school system and this relief for unfortunates transformed the role of the poor whites in the educational and political history of South Carolina and inculcated in the hearts of the blacks a vision which the citizenry of the world must admire. In 1872, the Republican Party split. Moses ran for governor, while the Reform Republicans nominated Chamberlain. Negroes were on both tickets. Moses, a white Southerner with aristocratic connections, won, and his administration was the most corrupt of the Reconstruction period. Negroes were alarmed and, despite the risk to their status, turned toward reform. They saw that it was not enough to vote. They must exercise greater control over administration of affairs. Moses was eventually criminally indicted while in office, but he escaped conviction on a technical point. Since his retirement from executive cares, ex-Governor Moses' adventures and financial exploits in northern cities have furnished the local reporters of police courts with not a few disgraceful items. Had it not been for the southern men of this and the Swepson type, men of high social standing, and they were in every reconstructed state, the northern adventurers would have been far less successful in their spoilations. A second taxpayers' convention met in February 1874. The legislature replied to its charges that the cost of government had increased only 38 cents per capita. It said that appropriations for schools, lunatic asylums, penitentiaries, and orphan asylums had been increased, while the public debt had been increased only about $5 million, and that the taxpayers' convention was composed of the former ruling class, which wanted to regain power. The effort of Negroes at reform was severely and definitely handicapped by the attitude of the whites. If they joined with the whites in reform, they joined a party which was more and more determined to disfranchise them and eliminate them from public life and impoverish them in economic life. It was this consideration that kept leaders like Eliot and Cardozo fighting within their own party, because they saw only in the Republican Party any protection for their rights, and they believed that the matter of Negro suffrage and economic progress was more important than even the driving out of the grafters and inefficient politicians. It was a difficult and desperate alternative, but they saw no way out. Even when reform movements under Chamberlain began, Negroes were apprehensive. Reform was in sight. In 1874, progressive and intelligent leaders of the party, including many of the colored leaders, elected D.H. Chamberlain as governor, and the reforms which he inaugurated and carried through were attested by the white people of the state. The Charleston News and Courier said, "He stands like a wall of granite between an obstinate people and those who seek by a foul move to rob them." The Charlotte Observer called him a model governor. The Grange, 1875, declares he was fulfilling the pledges made alike to conservative and Republican. The Barnwell Sentinel said that the governor will support no measure or policy that does not tend to advance the interest of South Carolina. A public meeting in Charleston gave him thanks for the bold and statesmanlike struggle he has made in the cause of reform and the economic administration of the government. The News and Courier in June says, "By supporting Mr. Chamberlain, the whole country will secure, without revolution, a government in every way satisfactory." The Chamberlain reforms consisted in retrenchment of the annual expenses of the state by nearly $2 million, and in an attempt to drive out the grafters who had been robbing the state. Many leading Negroes supported him, but others did not. Those who would not, like Eliot, had no confidence in the white Southerners behind him. Here was a chance for white Carolina to unite with the progressive Northerners and Negroes and usher in honest and efficient government without disturbing the right of black men to vote and the right of labor to strive through universal suffrage for its interests. When some Negro leaders refused to follow Chamberlain, this was from no opposition to reform. It was because they saw Chamberlain surrendering in many respects to those white elements in the state who were pledged to degrade Negroes and who were using reform as a stepping stone and an excuse for disfranchisement. It was a cruel dilemma, but their fears and suspicions proved true. The colored Speaker of the House in 1874 said of the colored voters, "We as a people are blameless of misgovernment. It is owing to bad men, adventurers, persons who, after having reaped millions almost from our party, turn traitors and stab us in the dark. Ingratitude is the worst of crimes, and yet the men we have fostered, the men we have elevated and made rich, now speak of our corruption and venality, and charge us with every conceivable crime." Independent radicals met October 2, 1874, and nominated John T. Green and Martin R. Delaney as governor and lieutenant governor. They said, "We cordially invite the whole people of the state to support the nominees of the convention as the only means of preserving their common interests, especially requesting the conservatives that have persistently declared that their desire was only for good government without regard to partisan politics to support the independents." Colored Congressman Ransier of South Carolina said in his speech at Charleston, March 9, 1871, "I am no apologist for thieves, for if I were, I do not think I would have occupied for so long a time a place in your confidence. On the contrary, I am in favor of a most thorough investigation of the official conduct of any and every public officer in connection with the discharge of whose duties there is anything like well-grounded suspicion. And to this effect have I spoken time and again. Nor am I lukewarm on the subject of better government in South Carolina than that which seems to be bearing heavily on all classes and conditions of society today. Still, recognizing that which I believe to be true, that such is the determined opposition to the Republican Party and its doctrines by our opponents, that no administration of our affairs, however honest, just, and economical, would satisfy any considerable portion of the Democratic masses in the state of South Carolina, and satisfied that the principles and policy of the great Republican Party, to which I belong, are best adapted for the promotion of good government to all classes of men, our party leaders should be judicious in dealing with the situation. And again, when you are called upon in your primary meetings, in your county and state nominating conventions, let each man act as if, by his individual vote, he could wipe out the odium resting upon our party and help to remove the evils that afflict us at present. Let him feel, black or white, that the country holds him responsible for the shortcomings of his party, and that it demands of him the elevation to public positions of men who are above suspicion. Let each man feel that upon him individually rests the work of reform. Let each man feel that he is responsible for every dollar of the public money fraudulently used, for every schoolhouse closed against his children, for every dollar of taxation in excess of the reasonable and legitimate expenses of the state. In short, Let every man feel that society at large will hold him and the party accountable for every misdeed in the administration of government and will credit him with every honest effort in the interest of the people and in the interest of good government, whereby the community as a whole is best protected and the equal rights of all guaranteed and made safe.